Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the show, powered by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Well, today, we're lucky enough to have the company of an internationally acclaimed rugby icon. David Campese earned 101 caps for the Wallabies and scored 64 test tries in a highlight-heavy career spanning 14 years. Breathtaking acceleration, a wicked sidestep. Campese is rugby's father of the goose step, his trademark move that bamboozled rivals. So if, as they say, rugby's the game they play in heaven, then the man known as Campo is manning the gates. David, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Mate, thank you very much. It's very kind words of you. It's unusual from someone down your part of the world.
We'll get to that in a moment. Oh, it's actually really good to talk to you, David. What is it? Barely a week or so after Australia was confirmed as the host of the men's 2027 Rugby World Cup, and of course the women in 2029 as well. It's an exciting time for the sport.
Yeah, it's about time we had some good news, I suppose. It's been pretty bare over the last couple of years. Obviously, we've had a few off-field problems, and it's great to see that the international board, in their wisdom, you know, after a couple of years, have decided to give to Australia, which we were the only ones who were going for it.
So how strongly did the game need it? I mean, what state was the game in this country, and not only at the top level, David, but all the way down to the grassroots?
Yeah, look, it's hard to actually pinpoint where things went wrong. I believe I brought out a book in 91 called On the Wing and a Prayer, and in 2003... And in those two books, I actually said, if we go professional, we will go broke. But I'm a winger, mate, so no one listens to wingers. We just score tries, and that's all. But I think the problem has been in Australia, you know, we're very fortunate. We've got a lot of codes. You've got, obviously, rugby union. You've got Aussie rules. You've got rugby league. You've got football. You've got netball. You've got all these other sports that are vying for a very small population of people. And I think in the 90s, the 80s and 90s, I think rugby sort of dominated internationally because of the World Cup in 91, again in 99, holding the World Cup here in rugby in 2003. And then after that, it wasn't really that good. So obviously 2015, we did make the final of the World Cup in England. But again, we didn't really bring the cup home. But I think it's over time of very, very competitive sports. A lot of money. Aussie rules obviously dominate because they don't have to travel anywhere except inside Australia. They're not really international sports. I mean, obviously, I'm talking a lot of Melbourne people giving me a hard time, but you know, I've been very fortunate in my life. You know, lived in Italy playing rugby, went to South Africa, lived there for 10 years. My wife's Zimbabwean. So rugby is an international sport where you can go anywhere in the world and play. Now we've got sevens. You know, the women were the 2016 Olympic Games in Brazil. They won the gold medal. So, you know, we've got a very, very opportunities for a lot of girls and boys now to play an international sport, and you can travel anywhere in the world. But again, if you haven't got the rights on TV, free to wear, where obviously a lot of Australians do watch, we did struggle, and I think that's been part of our problem for many years now.
I mentioned the goose step earlier. Have you still got one in you?
Oh yeah, I try every now and then, mate. It's very slow motion. But I just say go on to YouTube. There's a lot of people that have tried to emulate it. But obviously, yep, there's a lot of videos there. Yeah,
it would obviously become your trademark. But how did that come to be?
Well, I played rugby league most of my life. From Queanbeyan, it was a rugby league area, and I played league from 8 to 16. I think it was about 8 or 9. I was down in the place called Yass, which is about an hour and a half out of Queanbeyan. And I got the ball under my post. These two kids ran at me. I did something, scored up the other end, and these two guys had knocked themselves out. So I thought, that obviously works. But I've never practiced it at all at training. Never did, only in the game. I used to use it. And obviously, I didn't name the goose step. It was the journo, so the commentator. So I've got nothing to do with that. But yeah, I should have patented him back then. It would be okay by now.
Yeah, I mean, every kid was trying them at various points in their life growing up. Everyone remembers it. And I think Nick Farr-Jones once said, Campo, that you told him that your brain never knew where your legs were going to take you. Was it just pure instinct on the field?
Yeah, it was just one of those things that, you know, when you're on the wing as well, you know, you get the ball and off you go. Your job is to score tries. So I was probably the fittest. I was probably the hardest trainer. I was very dedicated. And what I would do is I would find ways, you know, to get around, kick right foot, kick left, played Aussie rules as a kid as well. So I could kick a ball properly. And, yeah, you just had to find something different. I didn't want to be a norm player. And yeah, mate, it's true. I mean, I got the ball, and wherever my feet went, mate, I went. I just followed them.
Yeah, and there's a risk of failure that comes with trying to pull off the brilliant, though, isn't there?
Mate, yes. Well, I'm probably known for, you know, copping a lot of criticism most of my life. You know, as I said, I didn't want to be a normal player. I wanted to be someone special. I worked very hard. I used to study the game. Playing wing fullback in Australia, but in Italy I played number 10, which is a playmaker's role. So as a finisher, now I became a creator. So I could read a game very, very well. I understood what the opposition were doing. And look, you know, once you know what your roles are, it makes the game very easy to play.
Throws one by Eels, Farr-Jones, Liner. Liner steps inside, swallowed by the All Blacks. Farr-Jones. David Campisi all the way! A great try from the leading try scorer in world rugby, David Campisi, came across and simply skated through the All Black defence.
Yes, I think a brilliant piece of running from Campisi will give you a lot of confidence. But here's the secret, it's a good ball at the back and Liner straight at the opposition, sets the ball up, in come the Wallabies. It's always going to be a quick ball, and I think actually plenty of options for Campisi here. He drew his men well and he could have gone to any one of two men, but he finished it off magnificently, really.
It's a roller coaster existence, isn't it? And you were obviously brilliant more often than otherwise, but was being prepared to fail in your psyche, was that a mentality that you carried with you all the way through?
Well, you know, you go out there, you don't want to fail.
Yeah.
It's simple. I mean, that was, if I knew that, I would never go out there. You know, I used an example many, many times of a guy called Rory Underwood, who was the English winger who I marked. And poor Rory stood on the wing waiting for the ball, never got it. And I said, well, if you want me to be like that, I can do that. But, gee, I'll tell you, it would have been boring. So I realised that the only way to achieve things is by working hard, backing yourself. But if you haven't got the skills or the confidence, it makes it very, very different, very difficult to do that. And as I said, by playing a different role in Italy as a number 10, now I just thought it was easy, you know. I'll give you a quick story about a test match. In 93, we played South Africa in the Sydney Cricket Ground. And I noticed the first two tests that down the blind, the old days, the old 10-metre kickoff, the forwards would get the ball, we'd come 15 metres inside the field. Their winger was like 20 metres back. They'd stick the hooker down the blind. So in this test, we kicked the goal. They came back and kicked off. And I spoke to Nick Farr-Jones, who was a great mate of mine. We played many tests together. And I said, listen, I'll call Leagy as a call when only the hooker's down the blind. So I called this. Nick looked, nodded his head, came down the blind, took the hooker out, gave it to me. I ran 20 metres, passed to Tim Gavin, took the ball up. Phil Coons took the ball up again. I went into number 12 off number 10, got the ball, passed to Tim Horton, scored in the corner. That's international rugby. How easy is that?
Mm. Yeah, well, you made it look easy many times over. Just the mental side of the game, David, the battle of wills, if you like. Did you enjoy that side of it?
No, definitely. I mean, you're always up against, you know, I played against the All Blacks 29 times. I think I won 8.
Yeah.
And that's, believe me, that's a good record.
Yeah, yeah.
some of the guys have never won. But you're always up against the best week in, week out. So it gives you something to aim for, you know. And I think in the 91 World Cup, it was probably the only time I realised we would beat the All Blacks. And we did in the semi-final of the Rugby World Cup. But, you know, it's all that. You've got to play the best to be the best. It's no good playing the lesser teams and winning. So we are really good. You've really got to, you know, push that the envelope. And playing the All Blacks, you know, then South Africa came in. You know, when you've got these teams who are really rugby countries, you know, that's when you really, because there's so much tradition, so much culture, that's when you pin yourself against, you know. As I said, a lot of the guys who I played with Australia came through a rugby league background. And back in those days, because it was amateur, you know, we actually enjoyed the touring. 84 Grand Slam, we had 18 games. We played every, you know, Wednesday, Saturday for 18 games. We were getting 20 quid a day. But for me, it was an opportunity to see the world, an education, and that's what rugby does.
Yeah. So just on that now, looking back on it all, what comes to mind with fondness? Is it just purely the thrill of the competition, that adrenaline rush of, you know, crossing for a try? Is it the World Cups, the Bledisloe Cups? Is it travelling the world and living in places like Italy for extended periods? You know, what comes to mind now, Camper?
Well, I just think everything. I think that I was given a bit of advice when I first started. Someone said, if somebody asks you to go somewhere, just go.
Yeah.
Don't say no, because 20 years later, you've got to go, jeez, I should have gone. So that was my way of life. If somebody asked me to go to Italy, I said, okay, I'll go. Very fortunate, obviously, to play for Australia for so long. And the touring was unbelievable. You know, you go to Shakespeare House in England, or you go and watch Craig Johnson, the soccer player, playing for Liverpool in 1984. You'd go to the theatre, you go to Rome, you know, you go to Colosseums, and, you know, it's basically a history tour for rugby.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I just think I was very fortunate, and I wanted to do it as well. So that really helped. And as I said, my dad's Italian, so I went to go and see the town he was born in, when I went to school there, the people, the relatives. I mean, you know, it's amazing the opportunities you get to play this international sport.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. We're about to go back to the 60s and the streets of Queanbeyan, which were roamed by a sports-mad kid named David Campese. That's up next.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, it's great to have your company on This Is Your Journey, made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're chatting to Australian Rugby Union Hall of Famer David Campese. So David, your father, Gian Antonio, or Tony, moves to Australia in the 50s. I think he was from outside Vicenza or Venice. We need to educate us here. We needed tradies back in the day, didn't we? And he was a very good one.
Yeah, that was the time where I think the Australian government realised to rebuild Australia, we needed some tradesmen. And Dad came out. He arrived in Melbourne, couldn't speak a word of English. Where my dad eventually built his house in Queanbeyan, the next door neighbour we called Uncle because he was from the same town. But my dad said the guy didn't even speak to him from Melbourne to Canberra. welcome to Australia. He built the house by himself. We had four kids, my brother Mario, myself, Lisa and Corina. And, we just had a little house. We had two bedrooms, obviously, two kids in each bedroom. And back in the days, it was a great way in the 60s, 70s growing up. My dad had a massive garden in the backyard, and we used to go around every afternoon and selling tomatoes and vegetables to the people in the flats and the apartments. Yeah, that was part of growing up back in the 70s.
And your mum, Joan's Australian born, and obviously you're raised in Queanbeyan. So did Italian ever get spoken at all around the home, David, or just the swear words from the old man?
Well, what do you think? It was the swear words. We knew them very well. But my mother's a Murphy. She's Irish. So, it's not a great combination, half Italian, half Irish.
Yeah.
We were just a normal, you know, Dad worked as his trade came out was a French polisher. But he ended up working for Stegbar Windows for like 30, 40 years. It was just, mate, we roamed the streets. There was no phones, you know, black and white TV. Every TV show was a comedy, not like now.
Yeah.
It's very different. So, So it was just a normal country kid growing up in the country, mate. It was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, so a typical Aussie upbringing, but not a typical rugby upbringing, was it? I mean, almost unheard of yours in the sense that you went to a local public school, you went to Queanbeyan High, I think, not a private one, which is where rugby was, or probably still is, predominantly played.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, Queanbeyan High was, Queanbeyan was 21,000 people. Most of the tradies who built Canberra lived in Queanbeyan. They called it Struggle Town. And, I played league most of my life. I played a couple of years of Aussie Rules, won a golf championship at 15. Played cricket, second-grade cricket. Did everything possible.
Yep.
And then one day I decided to, when I was 16, I think, to go and play rugby union. So in 1979, I played fourth-grade rugby for the Queanbeyan Whites. We won the premiership. Played first grade next year, and 2 years later played for the Wallabies. So very, very, it wouldn't happen these days, put it that way.
Just on the golf, I think you lived 100 metres from the local course there, and you won the 1978, yep. I think it was called the ACT Monaro Schoolboys Golf title, wasn't it?
That was it, yep.
So why didn't you persist with the golf?
I tried to, but then I really, like, it was to be a trainee manager, it just didn't sort of appeal. Yep. For me, even though playing all the sports, and what I've learned from that is, if my kids, Sienna's 17, very, very good at sport, Jason's 15, he's the same, and Mercedes is starting to get into it. And I said, guys, play every sport possible. One day you'll decide what you want to play. So there's never been any pressure. Have to play rugby. You have to do that. Just go and enjoy whatever you want to enjoy. Because what I did when I was growing up, I think, was very fortunate. My parents never really took a lot of interest in sport. Of course, I had an elder brother, two younger sisters. I used to just get a lift out by the bus to the sports and come home. That's how'd you go? Oh, we did okay. Okay, that's it. Okay, here's dinner.
Yep.
So there was never any pressure like now. Oh, my goodness. Every cricket kid's got his own cricket gear. He's got personal trainers. They've got this. They've got that. They've got high performance. And I said to my son, Joe, I said, mate, we had nothing. We just had to go out and play in the streets.
Yeah.
That's how we learned.
Yeah, yeah. And just total freedom, wasn't it? And no pressure, as you say. So you're playing everything then, David. You're into your cricket, your golf, we mentioned, AFL. Just with league, what happened? There was a rugby league grand final in 78. I think you're 16 and your team loses.
Yep.
Can you? This was a pivotal moment in your journey. Can you take us through this grand final?
Yeah, we went through the grand final and we lost the game, and they sort of blamed me because of my defence. I mean, that's continued on for 40 years. It wasn't one off. But anyway, yeah. So I went to the after match party at someone's house, and I was sitting there. I'm going, I don't need this. So I wasn't a drinker either. So I just said, I'm not playing anymore, and then went over and played fourth grade rugby.
Yeah. So you went there.
So my nephew Terry Campese, who played for the Raiders, played for New South Wales State of Origin.
Mm.
He played rugby for the schoolboys, New South Wales schoolboys. And I went to see him in Concord over, I don't know, how many years ago. And they didn't pick him. And so he went the other way. They didn't pick him rugby, so he went to play league. And he became successful in the league. So.
Yeah, it's amazing how life, the crossroad moments, isn't it? And you took yourself off to Queanbeyan Whites, like you mentioned, Rugby Union Club in 79, fourth grade, as you said.
Yep.
And you're 16 or 17 years of age here, and you're playing with men, aren't you?
Yep, that was the best academy you can ever get in any sport, is as a young kid playing with older guys, who they can, as you go along, they'll help you play. But fourth grade, 17, and all these old guys going, who the hell's this young kid at the back? So every time the ball went over their head, they didn't move because they said this young guy will bring the ball back to them. So they had a great year. We won the premiership, but it was a great learning curve because you got the experience of these guys, and that was what I loved about it, because I was so young, had no idea about rugby at all, just kept on running, and I was just very fortunate to be involved with a club that had a lot of older players who actually loved playing the game, and fourth grade's about having fun, and I still believe that was my best year of rugby ever, winning World Cups, Breeders' Low Cups, because I just had such a great time. It was so easy, and I learned so much.
Yeah, and just that word fun, isn't it? I guess how much of it comes down to just having the fun and the passion and the love for the sport? So as fans, we often see what happens out on the field, the product, if you like, the result, but not the preparation behind the scenes. So how much did you love training, love dreaming, loved having that goal to climb the mountain?
Yeah, well, I didn't really have a goal. Like, I just went along and played. You know, fourth grade, I actually asked the coach after one game, do you need a fullback? They'd lost. I said, yeah, and that's how I started. You know, but I was very dedicated. My fitness, I was always first in everything. I could learn to kick right foot and left foot, playing Aussie rules, obviously. I could, you know, torpedo better, do the proper kicking. And, yeah, I just built my skills. And I'd go over at lunchtime during work to the Oval and Taylor Park, it used to be called in. Now it's the David Campese Field. And I used to kick the ball around, do sprint training. I had a lot of really good guys like David Grimman, who was next Wallaby. We'd go running at lunchtime, you know, 5, 10Ks. So I had guys who were really willing to, you know, to help as well. So, and it made it so much easier and so much enjoyable to have players like that around. Unfortunately, these days, there's not a lot of older guys who are playing fourth and third grade because of time commitment. The game is a different game, so you haven't got the knowledge anymore for these young kids to learn from.
You're with This Is Your Journey, brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You can visit them at tobinbrothers.com.au. Next, the storied chapters of David Campese's career, the World Cups, the Bledisloe Cups, and all the glory.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. We're with former Wallabies try machine, David Campese. So, David, you graduate to the ACT under-21s, then the Australian under-21s, and then the Wallabies. Now, I've made that sound very quick, but it did move quickly, didn't it? You took a shortcut or two.
Well, it wasn't a shortcut. I just, as I said, 79 was Queanbeyan White, fourth grade. 1980 was first grade. 81 was the ACT team. 82 was the Wallabies. As I said, I don't think it would ever happen today. They wouldn't pick a skinny guy who was under 80 kilos playing the game these days, the way the size of these humans are these days.
Yeah, and I guess when I say shortcut, I mean, did it help not being, you know, a quote-unquote rugby person or someone who'd grown up in the private schoolboy system and perhaps, you know, not really being aware of the All Blacks or international rugby as such? You know, maybe a fat case of ignorance is bliss even?
Yeah, I think that's part of it as well. And I just because I didn't know how much about the game, you know, I just went up and played. I just thought it was another game and I treated every game the same. In 82, when I was picked to go to New Zealand, I got off the plane and the journo said, what do you think about Mark and the great Stu Wilson? And I said, Stu who? Honestly, I had no idea, which really helped. Yeah. I had no idea who these All Blacks were, but I found out bloody quickly who they were. They used to kick our backside. But that's part of, you know, now we're good mates. You know, most of my mates are around the world. And that's what, you know, I mean, I've got South Africans, got the French, Serge Blanco, some of these great players, you know, Jonah Lomu, unfortunately, who died many a couple of years ago. But I still keep in contact with all these guys. And that's, you know, for me, is part of rugby. That's what rugby is. It's the matemanship that you find along the line. So, yes. Fantastic.
You mentioned the Kiwis. Can you take us to Eden Park 86? So you beat New Zealand 22-9 at the Fortress as part of a massive Bledisloe Cup triumph. You know, now this remains, David, the last time an Aussie side unbelievably has beaten the All Blacks at Eden Park. What is it, 36 years ago? Something like 22 games ago. Am I right in saying you've got a reunion for this one as well?
Yeah, we try to combine the reunions because for some reason, up until about... probably about 10 years ago, no one ever talked about it. I think it was Alan Jones and John Fordham decided to have a function. Rugby Australia don't seem to want to remember what we used to do and how good we used to be. It's all about what happens now. Mm. And it's very, very frustrating because it was, you know, 86 was the last time Australian team beat anybody, you know, beat the All Blacks. It hasn't happened since. So it's very frustrating. We've got a great culture and great history. But we don't seem to want to celebrate. You know, it's just, oh, another day, oh, you guys won, that's great, you know, let's move on. You know, but I mean, that was the amateur era, you know. These guys are getting paid big bucks, you know, and yes, they lose and all that and whatever. But I mean, I don't understand why Australia is so much like that. The South Africans would cherish every test match. They get all the players together, have a captain's lunch and whatever. In Australia, you know, we can't even get a ticket out of Rugby Australia. It's very, very different here because I suppose there's so many codes. And, yeah, it's just part of... That's the part I don't like. When you think about schoolboy rugby, you know, it's private schools, they're all mates. But in rugby, for somehow, we don't seem to want to get to that point, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There was the inaugural World Cup in 87 that was won by New Zealand, and your Wallabies finished fourth. I mean, I think you ultimately called it at the time a disaster for you and for the team, but did it fuel what happened at the 91 World Cup? Obviously, the ultimate success and your named player of the tournament.
Yeah, look, it was. It was, but, you know, the World Cup 87, I wrote an article last week about it saying that if it wasn't for Australia and New Zealand, it would never start it. The IRB didn't want it. And have a look at it now,
yeah.
You know, the amount of money they generate. Yeah, so I think that all my years I played New Zealand, as I mentioned, the only time I knew we'd beat New Zealand was the 91. Because I looked at them, we played them in Sydney, we beat them 24-15. 2 weeks later, we lost 6-3. After that game, I could just see they were just about finished.
Far Jones digs it out. Liner, little chip ahead. Horan's going to chase that, so's Campisi. Campisi gets it in his hands. Campisi, David Campisi, dodging both ways and feeding Tim Horan. Horan to score. Tim Horan scores for Australia. A marvellous try, and it all came from that man, David Campisi, yet again.
And look, you know, I mean, to win a World Cup was unbelievable. It was, you know, it was just a mental process. It's not a skill or strong. It's actually mentally. You've got to turn up for 6 weeks, and you know, no game gets easier. You've got to really keep on going. And yeah, so it was unbelievable. 91, then 95 was a bit disappointing. I think that we probably had the same players. We're getting a bit older. We didn't really sort of. We had a couple of injuries. Then in 99 we've won it again. So, you know, we've been close, but we really haven't got to that next level. And obviously having it in 27 in Australia is going to be absolutely unbelievable. First we've got to get through France next year.
Just on 91, I think it was the All Blacks in the semi-final that you got the better of. Am I right in saying at this time, David, there was still no set rule, or rule's probably not the right word, but set plan as to what you did when you faced the haka?
That was true. I mean, as I said, after the game, you know, if we lost, I would have been in a bit of trouble. But I just went out there and kicked the ball. As I said, there was no set rules what we had to do.
Steve McDowell leading the haka. Well, interestingly, Bill Calcroft, David Campisi out there at the back didn't bother to face up to that haka. The rest of the Australian team did.
Well, I'm sure David's seen it enough times. He's just doing his own thing down there. It's all a matter for the individual preference. They probably know the words. I've seen it so many times.
And yeah, it was, you know, I just decided to go out there and kick the ball around and just relax and play the game. And, you know, now it's very different. But back then there was no rules. You know, we've tried a few times to do different things and, you know, as I said, luckily we won because I didn't stop as much from the Kiwis as I could have.
Yeah, because they're going through it, obviously, and you're off having a kick, I'm not sure, another part of the field altogether. What went into your thinking there? Why did you want to handle it that way?
No, I just wanted to do it. Yeah. It's just one of those things. I'm going to, you know, I don't want to stand around. It was cold as well, so I was more about trying to keep warm instead of sitting there watching the haka, which I probably could have joined in. I've seen it 28 times, so... I probably could have joined them. It wouldn't have looked too good.
And I'm obviously not saying this was the case in this instance, but were you a stirrer? Did you like to get under the skin of the opposition?
I think also there's probably, you know, a bit of arrogance. You know, when you play in international sports, you know, you get a lot of press coverage, and sometimes you do go off with the fairies. You know, you think you're better than what you are. And, yeah, look, I don't think I'd be the first one to acknowledge. You know, I was a bit arrogant. You know, I had a BMW back in the day. My number plate was number 11. And, you know, I'd say things which probably couldn't say. But, you know, because I was playing well, you do get to that point. So, yeah, it was just one of those things in life, mate. You know, you mature as you go along. And looking back now, probably what I know now and how I've been treated by rugby, I probably think that I could have changed a few things.
But don't you need a healthy dose of arrogance as well?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at a guy like Michael Jordan, I mean, he was unbelievably talented. and you ask him a question, he'll give you an answer, and it's probably the truth. And everyone says, you're arrogant. I said, well, you asked me the question. You know, and I mean, when sportsmen, you've got to be a bit arrogant. You can't be the best player in the world if you haven't got arrogance. You know, because you've got to go out there and back yourself. You've got to run the ball behind your own line. You know, if you just want to kick the ball out, you're not going to be the best player in the world. And I think that's part of it. You know, that's what drove me. You know, as a kid, you want to be the best. And one thing about rugby, which compared to a lot of other sports, you are the best player in the world, not the best player in Australia. And so that's the big difference.
Yeah, and not to dwell on the point too much, David, but when you come back to current day and you're saying now that the treatment you get from Rugby Australia, is there a tinge of regret you think there's an element of it that maybe you're being made to pay the price from what you might have said and done years and years earlier?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's unfortunate. It's a woke society these days, and it's very, very hard to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, that I'd like to say, but I can't say. But that's part of society, isn't it? You know, if you get ostracised, if you look at Lottie Dakiri came out to his next player last week and said that here's a list of rugby league players that rugby should buy to make sure we win the Rugby World Cup. You know, I find that very strange from a guy who we brought over to rugby, loved rugby, still involved in rugby. Why should we have to go to another coach to, you know, when we've got a system in place? We've got some fantastic young kids coming through who want to play for their country, who want to be like their idols. So it is very sad. And, you know, that's why you've just got to shut up, unfortunately.
There was one piece of genius, though, going back to 91 that came out of your mouth. You said England couldn't run the ball, David, and then they tried to and were exposed. So it was a classic hoodwinking, wasn't it? They were boring, you said, and they opened up and they were cut apart.
Well, they were boring, but there's two funny stories. But they came out that year to Australia, and we beat them by 40, I think it was 40 to 15, absolutely flogged them. And they tried to run the ball, and they were the triple crown champions or the Five Nations champions. So in the World Cup, they tried to do it, but it wasn't working. And you could see if they had run it earlier in the tournament, they would have had a lot more confidence. Because that World Cup, I mean, it was a defence that really kept us alive. It wasn't our attack. So you know that was part of it. But just a little story was in the game against. I think it was Scotland, England, and I think the score was like 9-3. And we were in Ireland before the day before playing the All Blacks, and we were watching this game. And after the game, the commentators, we've got a special presentation in the England dressing room. And they went down. There's Will Carlin, who was the captain, had the ball, and he threw the ball to Rory Underwood, who was a winger, and said, congratulations on your 50th test today. And I said to the players, I said, that's the first time you've seen the ball today. Because English wingers don't get the ball.
Yeah.
They honestly don't get it. But in the final, he gets the ball in the first 2 seconds. He's going, bloody hell, what do I do with this? They're just not used to it. So, yeah, it was part of the psychic. It was a massive week, mate. It was a mentally draining week. And also, the other thing was I didn't realise, but they'd sent journals out to Queanbeyan. I went to see my mum to find out who my ex-girlfriends were, trying to be a bit of dirt for, you know, typical English journos.
We're talking to David Campisi on This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey. Thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Rugby great David Campisi has been our guest today. The game, the way it's played today, David, you've touched on it a few times in our chat about how it's changed over the years, like any sport, I suppose, but the flair in the game, it's all about size and power and control now. Do you lament the fact that the game-breaking flair seems to have been taken out of it?
Yeah, I think what happened was the problem was that they, you know, the Kiwis dominated for many years, and after World Cups, everybody wants to follow the leader. And and it's become very structured. There's a lot of pods, they call, and people play and they have to run to a certain position. You know, we played a style of rugby which was Australian, which was a running style of rugby. You know, Bob Dwyer brought in, Alan Jones had as well, back to Bob Dwyer. And we had the talent. We had the guys who had so much flair, the Horans, Bar Joneses, you know, Roger Gould, the Ellers.
Mm.
You know, we played a style of rugby that everyone was envious. Now we seem to be follow like everyone else, and it doesn't really suit our style. The French have tried it for years. Now, the World Cup's in France next year, but they're playing a style of rugby that everyone wants to play because it's exciting. One thing in Australia that what we did very well when we had to up against Aussie rules and rugby league was we actually entertained people. It was different. People wanted to see, geez, that was good this week, let's go next week. You know, that was what people wanted. You know, I lived in Sydney. When I went to Sydney in 86, 87, I drove around Sydney. Every kid had a rugby league jersey. So after the World Cup 91, I drove around Sydney. Every kid had a rugby union jersey because of what we did and how exciting it was. And all the kids knew who we were. It was on free-to-air TV and all that. So, I mean, that's what we need and that's what we're missing. And unfortunately, you can still see today, you know, it's very, very frustrating. You know, Stan and Channel 9 are trying their best. But, you know, then you've got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you watch free-to-air TV, you've got Aussie Rules, you've got Rugby League on.
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand. You know, I just don't understand how we've got international sport, but yet these other local sports dominate because they've got so much money, so much to do. We are an international sport, but we have to entertain, and the only way to do it is you've got to play a style of rugby that people want to watch and come and play.
So when you look at the Wallabies now, do you think that they've just lost their identity in that regard?
I don't think they've lost their identity. I think the Wallabies has always been there. I just think sometimes, you know, we probably not backed ourselves as coaches. You know, we won two Rugby World Cups before anyone else in the world. 91, 99. Even the All Blacks, they won their 87. I don't think they won until 2011. You know, so we were dominant.
Yeah.
And we had Australian coaches. You know, that's the frustrating thing for me is that we've got some great talent. You know, you've got the World Cup in 27. You've got all these young kids playing, all these people playing grassroots around Australia, parents who give their time because they love the game. And then, you know, you see things like, you know, we want to get league players. I just don't understand what we're trying to achieve here, you know.
Just on league, now that you mention it, how many offers did you get from league clubs down the years, even when you were in your absolute prime representing Australia at rugby?
Probably three or four. I think there was the Raiders, there was Canterbury, there was Parramatta, I think it was St George, and St Helens in England as well. So, yeah, I was always there, but I've been through the league, mate, and I think that sort of haunts me, what happened to me back then. So.
Yeah. What keeps you busy now? What interests you, David? I think I was reading when you were in Italy, that might have been when you developed a passion for cars or at least for driving them fast.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes, that was a bit of a problem. You can't do it now. You can't go over 60 in Australia. Yeah, mate, what I do now is, obviously, I lived in South Africa for 10 years. I was coaching the Natal Sharks Super Rugby team, 2005 to 2007. Married my wife, Lara, who was a Zimbabwean.
Yep.
Met in Durban. We lived there until 2018. Came back to Australia, did some coaching, and now I'm the ambassador for Newcastle Hunter Wildfires, which is in the Sydney Shoot Shield competition. I haven't been in the competition since 1999. So I'm coaching kids, coaching the Colts, helping out, being supportive, and, yeah, just involved with rugby. Trying my hardest, mate, to pass on some knowledge and, you know, some stories about, you know, about playing the rugby and travelling the world.
No, that's great, and that is great to hear. But just the cars, sorry to take you back.
Yes,
have you still got an interest in them? You still get behind the wheel of some nice ones?
Yeah, when I was with BMW, I used to do the performance driving. I got M3R, which was a racing car back in the day, and there's only 15 in Australia. And as I said, my number was number 11. And to get to a set of lights back in those days, and every guy in the Hoon car thought that they can just, you know, drag you off. So off we went. I did go over the bridge at Harbour Bridge about 150 k's one day. I won't tell him on that.
I was going to raise that with you, actually. I thought it might have been 180, but you've dialed it down a bit. Was it 150?
No, well, I just thought I might be in trouble.
It took 30 off.
You know, getting older.
And not to embarrass you, but how often do people stop you and recognise you? And what is the typical fan? What is the first thing they typically want to talk about?
Either Goose Death or they're all from Tampo anyway. So it depends. You know, but let's talk about, I was at the train station in Cardiff, which is outside Newcastle, and the guy said, "Are you such and such?" I said, "No." I said, I had my name in my shirt. I said, "Oh, it's Campo, it's you. Oh, what are you up to? How are you going?" So, yeah. So it's, it's quite interesting. I just saw a guy there who's on Jetstar, and I see him all the time. "Oh, how you going? Good, you know." Yeah, I get probably recognised overseas more. That's where all my most of my speaking and functions are over there. It's a bit hard in Australia these days because you've got so many different sportsmen who are, you know, totally different, you know, available to speak. And, you know, I mean, I've got a story. I mean, from my background, not finishing school, you know, travelling the world, and then meeting guys like Berlusconi, meeting the Queen, you know, the people you meet, the friendships you made. I mean, it's been an absolutely fantastic life. And obviously, meeting my wife has been very supportive. And just, you know, getting our kids to play as many sports as possible.
Yeah, it's a great philosophy, that one. What a ride, what a life. David, thanks so much for joining us today. You are absolutely revered, not only for what you achieved on the rugby field individually and collectively, but also for the way you graced it, speed, agility, you know, a roll-the-dice mentality, and it made you must-watch each and every time you pulled the boots on. It's a great legacy. Well done on everything you achieved, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Mate, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
And thank you for joining us also. You've been listening to This Is Your Journey for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Jump online and find them, tobinbrothers.com.au. And we'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.